Okay, special program for you, because this hour we've got Yvonne Smith, hypnotherapist, and then later on for 2 hours, next hour starting, Robert Salas joins us with his story called Faded Giant. He had been with the Air Force for a number of years, and he's got an incredible case that he wants to talk about. Yvonne Smith began researching the UFO phenomenon in the late 1980s, and she received her hypnotherapy certification in 1990. She specializes in cases of post-traumatic stress disorder, observing that many of her subjects were describing a pattern of alien abduction and other close encounter experiences. She founded Close Encounters Resource Organization. Here she is on Coast to Coast. Yvonne, welcome back. How are you?
Thank you so much, George. I'm wonderful. I appreciate you having me back on the show.
God, you remind me of the movie The Fourth Kind.
Oh, no.
A little bit. I mean, that was a movie based on abductions and hypnotherapy.
It was.
But frightening. But are some of these cases, and we're going to get into some of these with you, are they that scary?
You know, it's unfortunate, George. I had so many people emailing me, asking me the same thing about Fourth Kind. I went to see it with some of my serial members. Of course, I was very curious about it,
mm-hmm.
because it has to do with my work. And I researched this supposed case of mass abduction in Nome, Alaska, and researched the doctor, the psychologist. I don't have my note in front of me.
Abigail something.
Abigail,
right? Yeah.
Right, exactly. And, you know, for those of us who have been in the field, I'm in this field now 20 years, we would have heard about this case. We would have known about this case. I researched it in depth and could not find anything in relation to a case in Nome, Alaska, or this particular doctor. And in watching the movie, I cringed at the portrayal of the hypnosis sessions, because really, George, it reminded me more of a demonic possession,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a UFO abduction.
And it was Hollywood.
And it was, and of course, yeah, they do have to sell their tickets. And I really had to assure people that were writing me and calling me that were thinking about doing regression and asking me, does this happen? You know, is this dangerous? I mean, in the 20 years, I've never had anyone commit suicide. I've never had anyone commit a murder suicide. I was horrified, to tell you the truth. And it's, you know, it's really unfortunate that the producers of this movie try to portray this as a documentary.
Yeah, they took a little Blair Witch and tried to squeeze some thing. And they even had phony websites made up to make people think it was a real story.
Yeah, and it just, you know, it. For those of us who are really trying to do some serious research, it really takes us a few steps back, because then we have to try to justify why is it portrayed like this. And, you know, I've never had, in the 20 years I've been doing this, I've never had anyone come to me and say they regretted doing hypnosis.
Well, you know, it was, Yvonne, it was brilliant viral marketing. But for people like you who are very serious researchers, it's got to make your job difficult, because it scares the living daylights out of people. Now, there is one guy out there of a few, David Jacobs, who might think that movie's pretty accurate. What do you think?
I don't know. George, I know that there's been some controversy surrounding David, and it's unfortunately, he's a close colleague of mine. I don't know the particulars of the case. I know there's some legal complications involved with this, so I really cannot comment.
Well, but he does believe that these cases in general are being done not for good purposes, that there's something very evil about it.
You know, there are some people I know that feel that the encounters with these entities are evil. I get the question all the time, you know, are they good? Are they bad? You know, we want to put everything in a nice little neat box. And really, I do not think they're either. They're not malevolent or benevolent.
Do you think they're happening?
Absolutely. I have so much documented now. I'm working on my second and third book as we speak, writing my second and third book.
First one's called Chosen, right?
First one's called Chosen, which is out now, doing very well. I thank everybody out there. And the second one that I'm writing is, believe it or not, it's a mass abduction. It's a very interesting case in the on Coronado Island in San Diego several years ago. 11 people were abducted all on the same weekend when I was emceeing a conference. At the same time, this was at the Del Coronado, that President Clinton was on the island as well.
Huh.
And in the same hotel.
So
I'm putting everything together, lots of notes, lots of regression and transcripts. So I'm hoping to have that out June of 2011. But, you know, people know me, George, by my abduction work and, of course, my book Chosen. But they forget that my specialty is PTSD. And PTSD can happen to, of course, our military returning now from Iraq, people who suffered as children, you know, some kind of abuse.
Oh, absolutely. It's got to be huge. Huh?
People that cleaned up after these terrorist attacks, for instance, at 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here tonight, and I really want to thank you again for giving me this opportunity to talk about cases, not only the abduction cases that I've dealt with for the last 20 years, but also I've dealt with people in the military who have had encounters, and not just abduction encounters, but close encounters.
Well, when I was 21 years old, I had the opportunity to interview via phone Dr. Benjamin Simon when he was in Boston,
mm-hmm.
who was the hypnotherapist psychiatrist for Barney and Betty Hill.
Exactly.
And he told me, and I will distinctly remember this, when I asked him, I said, do you believe that this couple was abducted? And he said, I believe that they believe it,
mm-hmm.
that they are not lying, that whatever happened to them was real in their minds, and that it's very possible. And that's what he said. And, he could not say to me, yes, it surely happened, but he also couldn't say, no, it did not.
It did not happen.
But he was convinced that they believed it happened. So that's pretty dramatic all by itself.
It is, and especially back in the day, you know, when Betty and Barney Hill had that experience. Of course, back then, nobody knew about missing time and abduction. And but here we have come a long way. And, you know, I had the opportunity to study with my colleague, Bud Hopkins,
mm-hmm.
For when I first started my practice, and learned so much. And in the 20 years now, I can say, George, that, and I know many therapists do not want to put their necks out on the chopping block, but I can say that people out there, and there are thousands, millions of people, I'm talking worldwide, are having true physical contact or abduction experience.
Now, can we say from what or whom?
At this point, we cannot. I mean, they describe, of course, as you know, the typical 3 to 4 foot gray beings with the large eyes. Those seem to be the ones that are doing the abduction.
Right. In the movie, they called it the owl, right?
Yes.
It was
yes.
a tight yes. shot. It looked like an owl when they were out of focus, and then when you mm-hmm. focused it, you clearly could see it. A very daunting-looking alien. Gray.
Absolutely. This is what we call a screen memory. It comes in the form of an owl or deer eyes. It's something about the eyes that people have a problem with.
And you get a lot of that in your hypnotherapy sessions?
Absolutely. There's a lot of screen memory. It's very, very interesting where people will have... have an episode of missing time, of course, they don't realize it until sometimes many years later. And they'll say, you know, I was driving with my family and we came across blinking lights and, it was ambulance and they were just blinking and then they don't remember anything after that. And something about the situation started haunting them, but later, many years later, and this is a strange component to what we call the missing time experiences, but it's very, very common. I'm at the point now where you become sort of like a police detective. So when someone contacts you and they begin to tell you about their experiences, and of course now we're at the age of email and text messages. Now I'm getting emails from all over the world, and people describe almost the same type of experience.
How do you find these people, Yvonne, or how do they find you?
They find me, George, probably, well, thanks to your show, my website. I do not advertise. I think, when you're in a business for a certain amount of time and you gain a reputation, people then come to you. And I wish I could help everyone around the world. I mean, I received just an email the other morning from someone in Spain, another one, from Australia. I mean, they're from all over the world. In fact, I'm doing another radio show out of Australia.
What have you concluded personally about this phenomenon?
Right now, number one, as I mentioned before, I know that these experiences are real. These people are not imagining these experiences.
But would you have to say, though, that they're real, like Benjamin Simon told me they're real? Like, something's happening to these people, and they believe it. We just don't know what it is.
That's exactly.
Okay.
We're getting a little bit closer. I mean, I feel very, very strongly that whatever these, whoever they are, extraterrestrials, will say, whatever they're doing, I feel that their agenda revolves around the hybrid program. I try to not talk about this too much when I'm doing an interview. Because I'm trying to reach out to the mainstream general public. So when you start talking about hybridization, alien and human offspring, because during the experiences they take ova and sperm, people are shown babies. I mean, we're really getting into the very depth of the abduction experience. I feel that that's a huge part of it.
See, what I think is happening, I think, one would think if they were benevolent that what they're doing is creating these hybrids and they want them to adjust for a future planet here, that something will happen. They know about it, some Earth change. And they're making between human and them, they're making this hybrid that could adapt to that. The good part says that's what they're doing. The bad part says they're going to come back and invade us with these things.
Well, that's the whole thing, George, is right now we don't know what ultimately is going to happen with these hybrids. Now, I think we're in that next phase. I think we've been in the phase for a while, but really did want to face it that these hybrids are already down here among us. I've had people tell me they feel like they've met a hybrid. And I know my colleague Bud Hopkins and David Jacobs both have said that many of their clients have said they have encountered them.
Are they kids? Are they grown-ups?
They're,
what are they?
Mainly when they're down here, they're mainly grown-ups trying to adapt to our everyday life. But it's, this is so complex, and there's so much involved in this. But that's why I wanted to, come on tonight and focus on the military cases that I've come across, because my co-host later, Bob Solis, my friend and colleague, is going to talk about his experience when he was in the Air Force, as you had mentioned to the audience.
Mm-hmm.
Well, during the course of my practice, I've had people who have been in the military who've also had encounters. And when I was discussing, you know, Bob's experience, and I, you know, thought back, oh, my gosh, you know, people that I've worked with over the years, I've worked with, oh, my gosh, it has to be well over 500 cases. Maybe I'm being, you know, maybe it's close to 700 cases by now. But I had somebody, for instance, come to me, George. He was in the Army. He came to me about 20 years later. He told me, he shared with me that his entire platoon, when they were out on maneuvers, encountered a very strange craft. They had no idea what it was, but and they couldn't remember anything after that. But when they returned to the barracks, they had found that many of the men in the platoon had urinated on themselves, had defecated on themselves,
Jeez.
They were crying, they were hysterical. And when this individual came to me in my office and was describing this to me, this had happened 20 years prior, he was hysterical and crying. He is still suffering from PTSD.
Now, do you hypnotically regress these people?
If they're ready, and if I feel that they're at the point in their lives that they're ready to accept what may come forward. Also, what I try to do in these multiple witness cases is get in touch with these other people to find out, you know, what they remember, and possibly if they're ready to regress, to be regressed, and see what happened. This I found so disturbing because of how upset he was. We did one regression. We've been in the process of locating these other men in his unit, but it goes to show that no matter where you are or who you are, you know, this could happen. I had another general from a foreign country. He encountered with his squadron, as he was flying, a very strange, erratically moving object in the sky. They couldn't catch up to it. And he felt that there was something more to what happened that day. He flew here to the U.S. and asked for me to work with him. And I'll tell you, as I mentioned before, this is a worldwide phenomenon.
It sure is. There's no doubt about that. And I want to talk about more of these cases with you, Yvonne, when we come back. Would you please give us your website?
I am at www.ysmith.com. Ysmith, that's my first initial, last name.com.
Okay, stay with us. Yvonne Smith, our special guest. We're going to continue talking about these incredible cases. We'll also get into hypnotherapy. I want her to explain how she puts these folks under, the types of questions she asks them, and what kind of response that she gets. It's fascinating. And again, she heads up what is called the Close Encounter Resource Organization. And we'll be back with Yvonne in just a moment right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're with Yvonne Smith as we talk about her work as a hypnotherapist. Tell us your procedure of hypnotherapy. How does this work?
Well, George, when someone comes to me, after I do the initial sending out my packet of information and doing an initial consultation with them, and if I feel they're ready, and many of them are referred to me by their doctor, psychiatrist, psychologist, then I begin set aside about 2 hours for them, and then begin the process of the relaxation. It's just using my voice, and it's just a matter of gaining rapport with each other and trust. And it's, you know, hypnotherapy, even though we discussed that movie four times, hypnotherapy is very, very safe, and it's extremely effective in retrieving hidden memories, in relieving PTSD symptoms. So once we go through that process, I bring them down into a deep level of hypnosis. Then we begin to go into the regression, just taking them back to a particular time in their life. Many times it's back to childhood, because as we know, this phenomenon begins in childhood and follows the person throughout their life.
Yeah, they're targeted, aren't they?
Yes, for whatever reason, once they're targeted or their family is targeted, and because it is intergenerational, it's a family affair, it follows them throughout their life. I wish I could take it away. I wish I could stop their experiences. You know, people ask me, can you stop this? No, I don't have that kind of power, but I'm certainly instrumental in relieving their symptoms and bringing the buried memories to the forefront so that they're able to deal with them. So they, once they know intellectually what they experienced, then it's not so frightening. Then it does not have such a power hold on them. And this is why I created CERO, Close Encounter Resource Organization, to give people a chance to get together once a month. It's a support group. Everybody gets together. They talk about what happened to them. They talk about their theories. They talk about, you know, what may have happened to their family without feeling that they're going to be ridiculed.
Do they feel violated?
Some do. Many times in the beginning of an experience, because, you know, we did not grow up with, you know, learning and knowing that there were ETs, that there were abduction encounters. I mean, we certainly, you know, back in what we're talking about, maybe during the time of the Roswell crash, I mean, we in the 50s, there were lots of, you know, sightings of flying saucers and so forth. But as far as something coming down here and taking us out of our environment, you know, we didn't grow up with that. So people did. When they realize they were having this experience or a strange experience, not knowing, they had no way to identify what this was. Many people say, "Oh, I thought it was a ghost. I thought it was, you know," they had no idea. So of course, once they realize, you know, I didn't give permission to have this done to me. I didn't give permission for them to take skin samples and blood samples and my DNA, they do feel violated in the beginning. But then, you know, later on, and I work with people for many years because it is an ongoing experience, they begin to incorporate this into their lives. Once the memories are brought forward, there is relief, there is healing, and they begin to...
And you see that personality change in a positive way?
I do. Many times, yes. They feel that they've become more spiritual. They feel that they've become more sensitive. Many of them, the people that have undergone this experience, are very psychic. Now, we don't know whether, you know, what came first, the chicken or the egg. You know, I think we're all psychic. I think we all have that ability. I think people that suffer some type of trauma. I work with people who suffered terrible car accidents, and they were near death and came back and felt, gee, you know, I have this ability that I didn't think I had before. So it opens up something within us. But it's wonderful to see that over the years I've doing this and people calling me that maybe I haven't seen for a while and saying, thanking me again for helping them through it. And they're able to get on with their lives. So that's my whole, this is number one, I'm a hypnotherapist. First and foremost. Number two, I'm a researcher. I never thought in a million years that I was going to write about this and author my first book, but obviously, this is my path, and I'm going to continue because there really is a need out there. There's not really nearly enough of us doing this work.
Well, now, you researched UFO phenomenon in the 80s, and you became a hypnotherapist in 1990. What came first, the chicken or the egg? Did the abductions come first, and then you said, I'm going to be a therapist, or did you want to be a therapist, and the abductions came, even though you were studying them before that?
Well, you know, I always wanted to be a therapist. I always wanted to be in the helping profession. But it was really funny. I really attribute this to my mother, who had asked me to attend a conference with her because she wanted to see Bud Hopkins. My mother's the one that showed me the Life magazine article of Betty and Barney Hill's case.
I think it was Look magazine.
Oh, I'm sorry, Look magazine.
Because my mother brought me Look magazine.
Okay, well, see, I came home and she said, look at these people. They, you know, they had an encounter, and at the time I think they called them flying saucers. But she was instrumental, and my mother, you know, she's a very open-minded woman, as well as my late father. And we attended Bud's lecture. I met him. I was impressed with his work and how he was explaining hypnosis. And
did you know John Mack?
At that time, no, I did not. But I had the honor and the pleasure of traveling with him. And it was a group of us, Bud and David Jacobs and John Carpenter. We all traveled and lectured together.
Oh, sure. John is just now starting to get back in this a little bit.
Oh, good. We miss him. We need him.
Good guy. I knew him in my Missouri days.
I see.
Then he got out of it.
He did.
And we talked to him about a year ago. I think he's starting to dabble in it or think about doing it again because he's been away for a long time.
Well, I'll tell you, you try to step away from this for whatever reason. You know, life happens sometimes. But if you're meant to do this work, it will bring you right back in.
Give me some of your favorite cases. No names, but tell us what happened.
Well, I'll tell you, there's so many. Right now I'm working on a very interesting case, a three-witness case with Dr. Roger Lear.
Mm-hmm.
And
good guy.
Jaime Masson. They brought these witnesses to me. I did hypnosis on two of them. We did a implant extraction on one of them, and we are getting in touch with the third witness to do some hypnosis on. And what was coming out of this is really interesting. And I was saying, you know, we've come a long way over the years, but my friend and colleague Roger Lear, with his ANS research, has told me tonight that we have enough information from these implants. I believe it's been maybe 15 extractions now, but enough information to identify the general origin of the ETs.
Hmm.
We're working with Robert Coons, who's a PhD nuclear physicist.
Right, just had him on.
And
it's like a who's who of coast to coast.
And this is, you know, we still have a lot of work to do on this case, but these witnesses, the two that I worked with, we did some filming with Jaime, and we're going to, you know, it's eventually going to be a documentary, but these were children when this happened. They were about 9 years old, and here they are in their 30s and looking into this, and that's not unusual. I'm trying to think of, that's one of the very interesting cases that we're working on right now.
And you would hypnotize all three?
I have the two of them.
Two of them.
And the third one is about ready to do the work. It's not unusual for someone to change their mind at the last minute because now they're faced with, you know, do I really want to know? And that's not unusual, but I believe he's going to do it. And I think it's important for all three of them, because they've had these memories since they were children. And what's very interesting about this is that they did not see each other after this camping trip until one of them started getting a hold of the others. And, you know, through our now Facebook and emails, they were able to get in touch with each other.
Oh, instantaneously.
Instantaneously. And they flew out. And so we're going to do some more work on that. But, you know, stay tuned, George, because we have some interesting results from some of these implants.
I'm going to do that. Have you ever come across anyone or anything that you think might have been a hybrid?
Have I come across?
Yeah. I mean, they came to you and thought they were being abducted, but they were hybrids.
They were hybrids.
Because I wonder if hybrids know what they are or who they are.
I believe from talking to Bud about his experiences with these hybrids and David Jacobs, I believe they do know that they, you know, who they are.
And I wonder if they know what their purpose is.
You know, the abductees are always told, and you probably have heard this, that they're being trained and for a particular job. And when the time comes, they will know exactly what they're supposed to do. Now, with the hybrid...
They're pre-programmed, then.
Mm-hmm, yes. They don't consciously remember now, but I have from all my... I think I've heard this almost from every case that I've had. And I heard it from Jim Sparks when I saw him lecture in Laughlin. I've not worked with him personally, but when I heard him speak about it, I thought, oh, my gosh, you know, when is this going to be? And what are they, what is their job? What are they supposed to be doing? People have had dreams of guiding large numbers of people, just guiding them somewhere. So, and I'm not talking about 2012. I honestly don't think the world's going to end then, but I think, you know, we're going through a shift somehow. And I feel now that there seems to be a lot of activity at this time. From the people contacting me, and I've spoken to other people, more sightings, more encounters, more abduction.
What percent of the people that you... hypnotize that claim to have been abducted, or they think they were, what percent of them claim that, you know, something is being done to them medically?
Oh, well, they all do.
It's all of us, 100%.
So one
would conclude then, just on the fact that it's 100%, that if abductions are occurring, it's got to be for a purpose of genetically manipulating, altering, or making these hybrids.
That's why this is why I mentioned this earlier. I couldn't have said that a few years ago. I didn't know. But now with the work that I've been doing with so many cases and people being presented, children, and also women that have been pregnant, feel that, you know, when they do have their babies, actually have their human babies, but they feel that their actual baby, human baby, was genetically altered.
Huh. And what does this tell you, Yvonne, about a species that would violate, you know, another entity, us, and do what they want to do and, you know, and do it at will? That doesn't sound very friendly to me.
Well, that's the problem. It is so secretive, and when the experiencers or abductees ask them, why are you doing this, you know, what is this for, they really don't give them an answer. It's basically, you'll be all right, you know, you'll be home soon. You know, they really are not given any type of answer. Now, I know a lot of people out there have had very positive experiences, and So they're not going to come to someone like me because the experiences are positive.
How could you have a positive experience? I mean, what would be positive?
Well, this is what...
Is this like the George Adamski cases where they took me up and I saw the solar system and everything looked
being,
good?
Yeah, that they're being, you know, they're sharing, you know...
But they don't tell them much about the future, do they? I don't think they do that.
Basically is that what we've heard many times in abduction cases is that we need to all take care of our planet. We have to spiritually evolve and grow and love each other.
I could tell people that.
Yeah. Sure, of course. Of course. Now, I'm not.
I don't have to abduct people to tell them that.
I'm not taking away from the people who say they've had positive experiences, but from my research, people are not being told what is happening to them, and definitely. The abductors have an agenda. They do have a plan. I'm just hoping that one day they don't pack up and leave, and that's it. We don't find out.
Look, if it was a great plan, let's look at the positive end of it for just a moment. And that is, they're genetically altering us, making hybrids to come back to a planet that they could sustain and they could live in, because the rest of us are going to get killed off by some calamity. You know, something will happen where maybe we can't breathe, a changing atmosphere or something like that, okay? But if that were the case, if they were doing something to benefit mankind, don't you think they would tell us instead of being so secretive?
Well, I feel that, yes, I feel that if they were here to help us, they would...
Well, I mean, what if they come by and say, look, 2030, an asteroid's going to hit your planet. All of you will be wiped out. All of you. And that's just the way it is. Now, we have made 2 million of you, you know, with us, and we're bringing them back when things clean up, and we're going to rebuild this planet. Well, my first thing to them was, if they're that sophisticated, why don't they blow this asteroid up before it got here?
That's right. You know? Yeah, they'd get rid of it.
So that's, there's something else going on here.
Oh, yes. And well, people are also told that they're not allowed to interfere with us. They're observing what we're doing.
Well, they can probe us and do whatever they want, but they can't interfere in our...
As far as, you know, saving us from ourselves, in other words. Yeah, I think they're very interested in what we're doing to the planet, because that may affect the rest of the universe. And I think this is what, you know, we're segue into Bob's segment, where he's going to talk about, you know, what happened there on the missile site.
Yeah, I can't wait for that. And you're coming back the last hour with Robert to take phone calls, right?
I would love to.
All right, we'll do that. Next up, Robert Salas joins us with an incredible story, former military. Get ready for this one. And welcome back to Coast. Robert Salas served almost 7 years on active duty in the Air Force until resigning in 1971. From 1971 to 73, he worked for the Martin Marietta Aerospace and Rockwell International on the space shuttle design proposals. From 73 until his retirement in 95, he worked for the Federal Aviation Administration. Robert wrote the book, Fated Giant, and co-authored with James Clotch, which details his UFO incident while stationed at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana. Here's Robert Salas this hour. Robert, how are you?
I'm real well. Fine, George. I'm happy to be on your show.
Good to have you here with this story. Now, take us back. Review for us this story of this incident in Montana, which was, what, 1967?
Right, 1967. We've narrowed down the date to March 24th, 1967. And... what happened, basically, I was on alert duty monitoring 10 nuclear missiles. This was Minuteman 1 at a place called Oscar Flight. It was at about 100 miles east of Great Falls, Montana. My topside security guard, of course, I was underground, about 60 feet underground, and the topside security guard calls down, and they say they've been seeing some strange lights overhead, and I just kind of laughed it off and kind of hung up on him, and then about 5 minutes later, he calls back, and this time he's very frightened. You can tell by his voice, he's screaming into the phone, and he's saying, "Sir, I'm looking out my front window here, and I see a glowing red object. It's oval-shaped, about 30 feet in diameter, and it's hovering above the front gate."
Jeez.
And he wanted to tell me what to do next. So,
and you're going, yeah, well, I don't know.
There's not in the book. So anyway, I think I told him not to let anything inside the perimeter fence.
Did you think he was nuts, Robert, at the time?
No, I didn't think he was nuts. I was more shocked than anything by his report. These guys were very professional whenever they reported something to us.
They don't joke around, do they?
They don't joke around. They know we've got nuclear weapons there.
Yeah.
We've got to be very careful. And what I did think was that very possibly we were under some kind of an attack. Someone was trying to get in our facility, and they had all their guns drawn. And so what happened next was one of the guards hurt his hand, and the main guard had to hang up the phone. And so I went over to tell my commander, Fred Mywald, who was taking a rest break at a little cot down there. And I was starting to tell him about the phone calls, and all of a sudden we get a lot of bells and whistles go off in the capsule, and our missiles started going what we call no-go, or an unlaunchable condition. They were disabled. And so while this object was still up there, our missiles went down. So, of course, we had to report this to the command post, go through our procedures, and we did that. And then I recall my world turning to me and saying the same thing happened at another site.
With a similar object?
With UFOs involved, right?
Okay.
And, when I recall that, specifically, that comment that he made. And then when I started researching this after I went public, I thought that he meant it happened that same night. But it turns out it happened a week earlier, and that would be the Echo Flight incident. So we're talking two incidents, very similar, UFOs overhead, shutting down 10 nuclear missiles each, so a total of 20 within the span of a week. This happened all in March of 1967.
And when you say shutting them down, destroying them to the point where you could never get them fixed, or
no.
Just what did they do?
No, what happened was, and we've got a way of monitoring the system. It's called Versa, but it just means it tells us what happened. And basically, the kind of message we were getting was guidance and control system failure, meaning that the guidance system was disrupted, so that the missile wouldn't know exactly where its target was. So.
What good would it be? You know, when that was out, you clearly couldn't launch it.
That's right. So that's why the missile shut down. They disrupted the targeting system. When I say they, I mean these objects, whatever they were, had to penetrate 60 feet of earth and then penetrate the cabling system, which is triply shielded underground cables. And inject some kind of a signal into the system to actually shut them down. So this is pretty fantastic stuff.
What did your superior say to you? They said, "Robert, keep quiet, don't say anything." Was this classified?
Yes. We had to report back after we were relieved by another crew. We reported back to our squadron commander, and we were told to go in and talk to our squadron commander. And when we went in, there was a member of AFOSI in the office with him. And my colonel was white as a sheet, didn't you know, didn't know what the heck was going on. If this had been some kind of an Air Force exercise, he certainly would have told me at that point. But he said he didn't know, had no idea why these missiles went down. Yeah, these things were very reliable, by the way, and we rarely had a missile no-go like that. And I was there for 3 years. Very reliable systems, and they're independent systems. And they, but at any rate, there was a member of AFOSI in there, and mainly what he was there for was to get us to sign a non-disclosure statement, meaning we were not able to talk about this at all to anyone. And he told us that, you know, in certain terms, that we would never should never talk about it to anybody. So we had to sign it, and we did.
Now, amongst each other, were you able to talk about it?
No.
Not even that?
No, not even that. He told us specifically we were not to talk to anybody, including each other or any of the guards involved. And as a matter of fact, a couple of days later, I got a call from one of the guards begging me to come and talk to him because this was a very frightening experience for them, as you can imagine.
Oh, I'm sure so. But, I mean, come March 25th, the day after the event, was it like business as usual?
Pretty much business as usual. And as a matter of fact, I was there for another 2 years, and we were never briefed on any of the investigation that was going on at the time as to why the missiles went down. And we got regular briefings. Every time we went out on alert, which was about every 3 days, we'd get a technical briefing on you know, problems in the field with the weapons or the systems. And so we would get briefings every day, and not another word was said about this.
Robert, 14 years ago on this very show, Coast to Coast, you went public with this story.
Yes.
How come? One, why'd you wait so long? Two, why'd you go public?
Well, the reason I went public was because in 1994, I was in a bookstore in Seattle, picked up a book called The Bump Top Secret by Timothy Good.
You right.
Heard of that.
Good guy.
Yeah, and I happened to flip to page 301, and right there said 10 missiles went down in Montana during a UFO event, and it was just a short paragraph. And so I got real excited because I thought, well, maybe the Air Force has released this information. And so I contacted MUFON in Seattle and asked one of the investigators, happened to be Jim Klotz, the co-author of our book.
Of your book, yeah, Faded
yeah.
Giant.
And you know, cautiously told him about my story and asked if he could write to the Air Force under the Freedom of Information Act and get some documents. And so he did. Lo and behold, the Air Force writes back and says, you know, this is still classified, this incident. Of course, we didn't mention anything about UFOs in our letter.
Okay.
And they said
just the down silos, I guess, right?
Yeah, just the fact that these 10 missiles went down for unknown reasons. And they wrote back and said, this is still classified, but since it's been so long and since you've requested it under Freedom of Information Act, we're going to declassify, and this is the ECHO incident, ECHO flight incident.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to declassify it, and we're sending you some documents. So they started sending us documents.
That's weird that they would do that, and very unusual.
Yes, and well, this was again 1994, and I think they weren't as cautious then as they are now, but they did, and so as a result, I said, at that point, I thought that I was the one that was at Echo Flight when these things went down. But as it turns out, I was not at Echo Flight. I was at Oscar Flight, which happened about a week later. And at the I had never heard of Echo Flight while at Malmstrom Air Force Base. I had never heard about that incident other than
my
that.
My gosh. That, so it happened again.
What's that?
And so it happened, what, several times?
Well, like I said, Echo Flight went down March 16th, 1967.
And you were the 24th, right?
Oscar went down about the 24th, yeah.
Now, you remember the Condon Committee?
Absolutely.
They were basically channeled to come up with a report of, you know, they came up after Blue Book, and right. I'm convinced it was their job to debunk everything. There is a connection to this story with that Condon Committee. Tell me what it is.
Absolutely. The connection is that Dr. Roy Craig was an investigator for the Condon Committee. I think he was one of their principal field investigators that went out and talked to people at different Air Force bases to see if there, you know, there's something they should look into. And he heard about the Echo Flight shutdown from Ray Fowler. Ray Fowler had been working for Sylvania, which was a prime contractor for the Minutemen, and he had told Craig, Dr. Roy Craig, about the Echo incident. So Craig comes out to Montana, I think it was in October of 1967, the investigation was still ongoing as to why Echo went down, but Craig was told by Colonel Chase, who was a base operations officer, I think, at the time at Malmstrom, that no, there were no UFOs involved. That was an outright lie, of course, because Chase knew very well that UFOs had been reported.
Mm-hmm. Regardless of what they were, but they were definitely unidentified.
Absolutely. And so Craig basically took his word for it, did not interview any of the individuals involved, and he had names to interview because he got those names from Fowler, and he didn't interview anybody. And this is all documented by both by Craig's notes, which we've got copies of, and also by his book. Dr. Craig wrote a book about his involvement with the Condon Committee, but basically he turns around and goes home. And does nothing about it. Supposedly, Robert Lowe, who was the deputy to Condon, was going to check in on the investigation later on because it was a classified investigation that was going on. And Robert Lowe was the only member of the Condon Committee that had access to classified documents during the investigation. So, but Lowe dropped the ball. And again, this is documented. Actually, Dr. James McDonald, I don't know if you know that name, but Dr. McDonald kept pressing Lowe. And we've got.
Was it James?
Dr. James McDonald.
Yeah.
He kept pressing Lowe to get this investigative report, and Lowe just dropped the ball. He just did not pursue it. So basically, there was a collusion there between the Air Force and the Condon Committee
to quash this thing, right?
To whitewash this thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and if anybody wants to read more about that, I've written up a summary of what I just said more detail on UFO Chronicles. If they want to go to that website, the UFO Chronicles, so they can read more about this.
Why do you think there was this collusion or this apparent cover-up? Why were they trying to cover this up?
I think the Air Force just wanted to get out of the business of having to investigate UFOs and report back to the public. You remember the Condon Committee was initiated in 1966, as a result of the Michigan sighting.
Right. The ones that Hynek called swamp gas.
Right.
And it haunted him for the rest of his life.
Right. So there was an outcry, really, because there were a lot of witnesses to those sightings, and they got on Congressman Gerald Ford. Remember that name?
I remember him. He also was on the Kennedy Committee before that, wasn't it?
Right. And so they got on his case. And so Gerald Ford called for, an investigation of the whole subject of UFOs. And that's how the Connick Committee came into being. The Air Force said, okay, we will award a $500,000 contract to the University of Colorado to investigate this. But, we've uncovered records where the Air Force and the Connick Committee had meetings with these base UFO officers, so-called base UFO officers, to discuss how they were going to work together and basically how they were going to whitewash the whole thing.
Tragic. Well, no doubt, this was the Condon Report. The plan was to end public knowledge of UFOs. And it was a sneaky way for the Air Force to get out of it, which I don't think they ever did.
No, because obviously more sightings and more witnesses came forward. And so right now I think the Air Force and the government as a whole is on the defensive on this issue because there have been so many credible sightings and so many reports. And I think they're just hunkering down and hoping it'll go away, but it's not going to go away.
How many guys total, soldiers total, were involved in your episode?
Well, in my particular episode, we had our two guards and the main guard, the flight security controller, and then
you.
Myself and Mywald, and then at the Echo flight, we've got Walt Fiegel and Eric Carlson.
All of you today would say the same thing, right?
All of us today would essentially say that UFOs were involved in the shutdown of our missiles.
As a matter of fact, and we're going to talk about this, because at the end of this month, you're going to be at the National Press Club in D.C., with other witnesses. So we'll talk about that. Get your take, Robert, on what you think these craft might be. We'll be back. And welcome back. We're with Robert Salas. Robert, you've had years to think about this. What do you think these objects were?
Well, I know they were, let's say, not of this world. Again, the technology needed to disable our weapons, which they clearly demonstrated, it was just fantastic. Like I said, they would have had to penetrate 60 feet of earth and concrete and those cabling systems and inject some kind of a signal to do this. And at the same time, hovering over a site quietly the way they did, we have no technology that even today that could do that. So in that sense, since we here on Earth don't have the technology, it must have been some technology not of this Earth.
Now, they could have destroyed the 10 missiles. They didn't do that. Wonder why.
Well, I think it was a demonstration. The demonstration was that they had the ability to disable our missiles. And in addition, I think there was a message there, and the message being, get rid of your nuclear weapons. To me, it was just saying, we'll shut you down, and you don't need these things, and get rid of them. So I think that was a clear message as far as I'm concerned.
Well, here we are 43 years later.
Mm-hmm.
We still got them. We haven't gotten rid of them. We probably have more than we had then.
No, we've got less, but still, they're still there. We're making progress, but this is a serious problem. Obviously, I don't have to go into detail, but we've got eight countries now, by my count,
yeah.
that have nuclear weapons, And some of those countries, like Pakistan, for example, have unstable governments. These weapons can easily get into the wrong hands. And if
well, that concerns us about Iran, for example.
Exactly. Exactly. And so this is not a laughing matter. It's something that needs to be taken seriously. We've got to get serious about getting rid of our nukes. The only thing they're good for is destroying the planet. They're not good for anything else.
Do you think that if we were very close to a launch day or moment, that they'd step in and disarm again?
I would hope so. They have shown that they can do this, and I would hope that they would intervene. But I don't want to bet on it.
You think they'd let it happen?
I don't think so, but I don't want to bet on it. What I'd rather see is all of us coming together, all the nations of the world coming together and finding a way to get rid of our nuclear weapons together. Yeah.
See, I think somebody will always hold one back, you know?
Yeah, we got rid of all of them.
But they hold one back.
Possibly. Yeah.
Have there been other similar incidents, Robert, around this planet, around military bases where this has happened?
Many, many incidents. Let me just give you a rundown. Of some of the witnesses that we'll have at our press conference.
Just in a couple of weeks, yeah.
Yeah, just in a couple of weeks. Dwayne Arneson was a cryptographic officer at Malmstrom Air Force Base. He saw top-secret messages about UFOs hovering over missile sites. Bruce Fenstermacher, Minuteman III missile launch officer, Warren Air Force Base, 1976, again, UFOs over missile sites. Colonel Charles Holt, I think everybody knows who he is at Bentwaters. He's going to also be one of our witnesses coming forward and talk about UFO shining a beam at a nuclear weapons storage area. I don't know if he can say that himself, but we know that there were nuclear weapons at Bentwaters. Robert Jameson was targeting officer at Malmstrom. He's going to back up my story because he had to go out and restart all those missiles that went down. Pat McDonough, and he's also going to talk about UFOs being briefed to him as being a cause of the shutdown. So he's another supporting witness. Patrick McDonough, who was a geodetic surveyor at Malmstrom in 66. Again, UFOs came over the sites. Jerry Nelson, Atlas F missile launch officer at Walker Air Force Base in 64. His guards reported UFOs over his sites. And myself, of course. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. There have been Robert Hastings wrote a book who's mm-hmm. also going to be.
Yeah, we had him on a few weeks ago.
Yeah, and he knows of over 100 cases, such cases of UFOs over missile sites. So again, it's a clear message. The UFO nuclear weapons connection is a clear message, I think, coming from whoever these objects are coming from.
This is dramatic.
It is. It is. And it's significant. And again, this happened in the Soviet Union. You're probably aware of a case in 1982, Lieutenant Colonel Vladimir Plotunov, where a UFO came over and actually started his missiles on a launch sequence. It scared the heck out of him.
wasn't there also a moment where a UFO situation got the United States and the Soviets at the time to think one of each other might have been ready to launch?
Well, You know, that was actually the basis for that movie Failsafe. I don't know if you ever saw
that. Yeah, yeah.
But I'm sure that probably happened where, you know, we're monitoring the skies and some unidentified object starts approaching our airspace and we have to go into a high alert status and possibly, you know, go into different DEFCONs. So, yeah, it's a very precarious situation.
Man, that is dramatic. So why do you think more and more countries are beginning to disclose a little bit more by opening up their UFO files?
Yeah, again, I think the reason is because the public is clamoring for it. You know, the public is asking for it. The government can kind of play coy on this issue, but they cannot avoid public outcry over the many, many incidents from reliable witnesses, you know, police officers, airline pilots, you name it. There's been so many incidents that I think governments can ill afford to ignore the issue. And I hope that our government, our U.S. government, starts listening to people like the witnesses we're going to have and start, telling the truth about this to the public, because the public does have a right to know about this. You know, there are things that ought to be kept secret, no doubt, but something of this import where it affects all of us, we have a right to know, and we want to demand that from our government. You know, President Obama promised an open government. We're going to try to hold him to that promise on this issue.
How does it feel, Robert, knowing what you know, knowing what you believe about these craft? What does that feel like? I mean, I would love to have that close encounters type feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'll tell you, for some time, even after I went public and even after I went through this experience, it was more like it was an interesting, you know, story. It was an interesting thing that happened. But, you know, as the years have gone on, it really has hit me how the reality of this phenomenon. It's real. There's no question about it. And there's no question in my mind that these are extraterrestrial. Absolutely none. And so this is a phenomenon that has to be taken seriously.
I mean, to have the belief system that there's life out there, mm-hmm. in other systems, and that we've been visited, maybe visited since the beginning of mankind, you know, maybe the theories of Zechariah Sitchin and the genetically altering of us truly are real. And we have had a profound life, and they have had the profound effect on us. This is just dramatic stuff.
Yes, it is, and it's hard to assimilate this. It's hard to, you know, get to the point where you really, really, in your heart, know that there's other life out there that's been visiting us. But I think I've gotten to that point finally. and that's why I'm speaking out. I want the public to understand that this is real. And that's why these other gentlemen that are ex-military are going to come forward and speak their mind.
Would you like to meet these occupants?
Absolutely. Certainly.
Would you go with them if they asked you to?
I don't know if I'd go with them. I hadn't thought about that. I
would go if they brought me back within a reasonable time. I mean, I wouldn't want to come back and 50 years had gone by.
If you had a return ticket, okay.
Yeah, well, in an early return ticket. You know?
Okay. Well, yeah, it's... you know, it's a good question, and we may have to face that question someday. About how do we assimilate with these ETs? how different are they, and how far more advanced are they, and could we even hope to understand who and what they are? These are all very interesting questions.
You signed a security oath way back when, 40-some years ago.
Right.
Do you think the government's going to show up at your event on the 27th?
I invite them to do that.
You want them to take you away?
Absolutely. Well, as long as I get a fair trial.
But see, that's probably why they won't.
Yeah. And
do you imagine the exposure this would get if they arrested you for violating that security oath by coming forward and saying that 10 missiles were shot down by extraterrestrial craft,
right,
and they're trying to prosecute you for that?
Yeah, and they've been saying all these years that no UFO incident has ever been a national security concern, and that's an outright lie. And that's been published for years. That's the Air Force position. And it's wrong. It's just an outright lie, and it's outrageous. And that's why, you know, we're also talking about excessive government security here. You know, we're talking about our democracy. You know, we have a right to demand our government to tell us the truth. Our government should not be lying to us. After all, they're supposed to be working for us. So that's the other issue here that's important, is excessive government secrecy.
Well, you know, in a perfect world, we should expect this full disclosure, but we're not in that perfect world, Robert.
No, we're not.
Are scientists getting involved in this, either in a clandestine way or publicly?
Well, you know about Leslie Keene's new book.
Yeah, she was on too.
And I was really heartened to see Dr. Michio Kaku come forward and support the possibility that, or, well, support her in her book. And so I think more and more scientists are starting to think twice about this. Of course, nearly all of them want to hold on to their jobs, and they don't want to be laughed at. So, you know, the other issue is, can we get this thing off the laugh track and get a more serious conversation going? And when we do, I think more and more scientists will want to look into this, because there are cases that science can look at. You know, even in my case, there's a lot of technical documentation available. We can demand more, technical reports that were written on our case, and it could be looked at in a scientific way.
So you do not believe that these ETs were attacking us?
No, I don't think they were attacking us. They obviously have the ability to disrupt our electronics, and if they wanted to attack us, I think what they could do is just shut down nuclear missiles all over the country and keep them shut down, and then they would disable our nuclear arsenal. But what they simply did was make a demonstration that they could do it, but also I think it was a message, and that was get rid of your nukes. They're not going to do you any good.
Do you think governments around this planet where this has happened probably have talked to each other going, you know what, they could shut us down in a second, mm-hmm. all of us. Mm-hmm. We got to get smart. Mm-hmm. You would think they would be saying that.
Yes. I think there are conversations going on between governments on the UFO issue. Of course, I'm not privy to any of that, so I don't know what that conversation is like.
Robert, think back 43 years.
Uh-huh.
What would you do differently, knowing what you know now, 43 years ago?
What I would do differently is try to. Demand that we get some answers as to what exactly happened. the investigation that was going on, we should have been briefed on the investigation going on at the time. Of course, you know, as a military person, you just have to follow orders and you can't do much demanding about anything.
Would you have still signed that security oath?
Would I have signed a security oath?
At that time, yeah.
Yeah, I really had no choice. Yeah, I guess I would have. I sure would have. I would have probably done the same
thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Has anybody been emotional over this, you or the other six witnesses, where it's affected your life?
Emotional. Well,
I mean, sometimes you would think if you were faced with the true reality that there's extraterrestrial life out there.
Yeah.
And you truly knew that. I think it would be pretty emotional.
Yeah. I can tell you that the two guards, we sent out two guards to one of the launch facilities where we had security violations. And they saw UFOs over the sites at those locations. And when they came back, they were really shook up. And they had to be removed from alert status. In other words, they had to be taken off the job because they were so distraught and fearful over the whole thing.
All right, Robert, stay with us. We're going to bring Yvonne Smith back with you for some phone calls now for the final hour. And by the way, you can go to another website, UFOHastings.com, UFOHastings.com, to get more information on that Washington Press Club conference. We'll be back. And welcome back. Yvonne, you were right. Robert's story is truly something else, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yes, I told you.
Gosh. Now, have you, you have not had to hypnotherapy him, have you?
No, I have not.
Would that be beneficial? I mean, he has full recollection of things.
You know, many people, a good percentage of people have conscious memory of their experiences. But sometimes they want to make sure that they are remembering everything. I mean, they just need to know. So that's when they'll come to me and they want to try hypnotic regression. But if someone's satisfied with their conscious memory, then I just advise them to just leave it alone, and you know, they can seek out help later if they need to. But conscious memory is fine. Many people have that.
And Robert, I hope you get some major media at this September 27th event.
Thank you, George. That's what we're hoping.
Let's take some of the calls. We'll go to Leonard in Eugene, Oregon, west of the Rockies. Hi, Leonard. You're on with us.
Hi. First of all, I'd like to say thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
I actually live in Eugene, Oregon. There's an artist who drew a picture of an ET in the window. I live in the same city. I'm 26. I'm Generation X. I'd like to start this story off by saying about 20 years ago, I lived on Fox Hollow Road, and I was 7. My sister, she was about 14 or 15, and she came to me one night and said, "Hey, Len, Dad said it was okay for you to help me doing my paper route, only on the weekends because I was young." I said, "All right." And as she walked out of the room, I was getting in my bed, she said, "Oh, and Len, there's these things in the sky." And when she said that, I was 7. I didn't think anything of it. All I knew is early in the morning, dark, I was going to take my bike, ride it down the middle of the street with my sister, no dad around, awesome. So I didn't think anything of it. When we got there, when you go and do a paper route, you have a drop box where you pick up your papers. As soon as we got there, I heard the things in the sky. And I want to give an illustration. It sounded like a fire extinguisher. When you pull the trigger and it makes that noise.
Yeah. Yeah.
Very loud. I looked up in the sky and I saw a trail of smoke, white smoke. And I said, "Whoa, what's that?" And she said, "I told you, Len, there are things in the sky." And so on that specific road, it's Oregon, there are huge trees. We couldn't see above us very well. She said, "Let's go ahead and deliver these papers at the end. It opens up. We'll take a look." So we did. We got to the end where Fox Hollow Road and Pinecrest is. We stood at a stop sign. We looked down the street. I saw about, this is a true story, we saw about 20 to 30 cats in the middle of the road. Some were laying down, some were standing, some were just sitting there, some were looking up in the sky. And we said, me and my sister told each other, they must hear them too. that's when we got distracted because those things started moving up in the sky, and we got terrified because we realized there was more than one. There was about three or four of them. We could only see the trails of smoke they were leaving, but they were doing zigzag patterns. And I looked down at the ground. I looked up at my sister. I saw her go, and that's all I remember from that point. I don't remember walking past the cast. But here's my question. That same year, I went into foster care, never got to think about that again. My life changed. And a couple of years ago, I had my first son, my firstborn son.
Well, congratulations on him.
Thank you. Well, it was late at night. He was 3 months old. He's around 2.5 right now. And I woke up in the middle of the night around 3 o'clock, and I had the weirdest feeling. My body was tingling. I felt like somebody was going to break into my house. I know that sounds weird, but I checked all the windows. I turned off all the lights so I could look outside the window and make sure nobody could see me. And I kept walking around my small, small apartment. And when I walked back into the living room where my son's crib was, there was this black shadow figure. I know everybody here is aware of the cartoon figure, the Grim Reaper, the black-robed figure with
mm-hmm.
He didn't have a staff. It was just a black-robed figure looking down at my son. I stood there for 2 seconds. It hovered all the way across the room, vanished through the wall. I stood there. I went and touched my son, made sure he was alive. I had no clue. I didn't tell my wife. I laid back down and went to bed. It sounds like the weirdest thing somebody would do. I always told myself if I ever saw a ghost, I'd get out of the house. I'd just run. Well, I started doing investigating, and the more investigating I did, the more and more I started looking into it. I heard of the term shadow people. And that's when I started listening to your show, George. And ETs kept coming up. ETs kept coming up. And that's when I started thinking about my ET experience.
Do you think you were abducted, Leonard?
Absolutely. And that's where I want to get to. After this had happened, I never told a soul. I just started looking into it slowly. Well, one evening, I did security work at this time, working graveyard at a college. That's why I loved listening to your show while I was working. It was great.
It's the best at night.
It's the best. Well, I was sitting there, and all of a sudden I heard this come from the back of my head. Instantly, back of my head got numb, got nauseous to my stomach, didn't know what to think of it, just walked outside, started talking to my family, didn't tell them a thing, didn't want to think about it, didn't know what to think about it. A month later, I was laying my son down to bed to take a nap, and I heard this come from my head. Now, this lasted a good 30 to 45 seconds. And I was about to jump up and run out and tell my wife, and I said, "Why, what are you going to tell her? You're hearing a noise from your head?" And I said, "No, study this noise and just listen to it." Well, within the next couple of months, I heard that exact same noise come from my car when I would be listening to the Coast to Coast. It started popping in through my speakers. One time, I got out of my car. I had a Walkman, a tape player Walkman. People say, "Why are you carrying that around?" Because they have an AM player. MP3 players nowadays don't, but those old disc players do. That noise came from my headphones, and that's when I realized something really strange was going on, and that's why I wanted to ask you.
And let's do that for Yvonne, yeah.
Yeah, I want to do this for Yvonne. Have you ever heard of anybody hearing a transmission noise coming from the back of their head like that? I'll be honest with you. I kept this secret for a year at least. My wife started noticing that I was investigating, looking at different groups and chats, and she was like, "Okay,
what are you doing? Who are you seeing? Yeah,
I finally said, "Fine, I'll tell you." And this is when I was working security, leaving at night, and she was terrified. She never wanted to hear a thing about it.
Let's start with the beeps first, Yvonne. Have you heard that before from some of your other patients?
I'm trying to think back at some of my cases. I know that with the suspected implants, people have heard certain tones. Now, I'm not saying that specifically what you heard. Of course, I have dealt with so many cases that it's on the top of my head. It's hard to remember that exactly, but they have heard tones, and they've actually have heard someone communicating to them, and we feel that that is part of
reason for the implant.
And he was so vivid with those tones, too.
Yes, they are very, they're clear. It's almost, I know I had one client say that he felt that there was communication coming through it, and it was just in one ear. Now, you know, you have to be careful, of course, and I understand that when you didn't tell anybody for a long time, because if you start saying you're hearing voices, you know, you have to be very careful with that, because people will start thinking you're schizophrenic, and but you have to really rule everything out.
And let's ask Robert, too, Yvonne. Did you, Robert, or any of the other witnesses hear any sounds from these craft?
The witnesses topside, I have heard reports that they did hear a kind of a low hum kind of sound. But, of course, I was underground 60 feet, so I didn't hear anything. But there have been reports of sounds, yes.
Well, you know, in Leonard's case, Yvonne, he sounds like he's a prime case for hypnotherapy.
Yes, and Leonard, I suspect that... Well, you said you saw a group of cats in the road.
Well, you know, they're sensitive. They hear these things. They pick up on things.
I mean, it could very well be. Also, it could also indicate that could have been a screen memory.
And explain that. What does that mean?
It could have been where screen memory, how it works is the person the extraterrestrials, the aliens, are
or whatever they are,
a memory into the person's mind, making them think that they saw an owl, as we spoke about before, or a deer, or a ambulance, an accident scene, and in reality, it's them, and this is the onset of an abduction experience, and I'm not saying that. They weren't real cats. They could have been. Like you say, George, they're sensitive, and of course, they, you know, they could have heard the sounds. But it also could have been a screen memory, which is a good indication. Now, it's up to you, Leonard, if you know you want to pursue this. Have you undergone hypnotic regression yet?
No, I don't think he has.
No, okay.
He's gone.
Oh, okay. Okay. You know, yes, he sounds like a very prime candidate for this. But again, you know, the person has to be ready and has to be sure. And their life has to be stable, you know, where they're not going through some major stressors, you know, a divorce, a moving, buying or selling the house, you know, just because this is... this information can be earth-shattering for someone.
If you had heard that story, would you have taken him on as a patient?
Yes. Uh-huh. I mean, I would have interviewed him, of course, and if you're, you know, if you're ready, I would say, because again, you know, he's describing a childhood experience with his sister, very, very common. They don't remember everything, but they'll remember bits and pieces of it. So it's this is what I hear.
Let's go to Euless, Texas. First time caller is Harvey on Coast to Coast. Hey, Harvey, welcome to the show.
Yes, sir. Thank you, George.
Sure.
Has anybody ever called you and told you about the alien life, UFOs? Not they have the ability to be invisible, invisibility.
Yes,
100% invisibility.
Yvonne,
aliens have the ability to.
And or their craft.
Oh, right. Absolutely.
Okay, well, I had an incident one night. I'm a member of an outdoor gun range. I go out there at night to look at the moon, and they don't know I'm there. So that's another reason why I joined it. But one night I was out there. I didn't know they came down. Before that, I saw this big ball of light. After all that happened, they cut their light off. I was talking out loud. Up in the sky that night, the light, the cloud cover was as far as you could see from horizon to horizon, 306 degrees, total covered over in a black cloud cover. I was talking out loud, complaining about my friends. I said, okay, now I'm ready to look at the moon. Our camera's ready. How about let me look at the moon? They opened the cloud cover up for me, circular pattern, right where the moon was and no place else. I got to see the moon. I says, okay, I've got it, and shut it down, and they closed the cloud cover back up. They have 100% invisibility. I did not know they were there. On a reason why I'm calling now and let you know and know is because they allowed me to see this ability. That cloud cover opened up right where the moon was, perfect circular pattern, and closed back down. And, George, please, I need to talk to you off the air.
All right, we'll get your phone number after this, okay?
Please. I've tried to leave it before. They wouldn't take it.
Oh, Tom will take it.
Okay, but they have my name. You know I'm in Euless. And once before, I was out there at the outdoor gun range. I have a problem sleeping. I have to use a CPAP machine to allow me to sleep so I can get some sleep. I have a very bad thing about snoring. I was too tired to come home one evening. I stayed out there, slept in my car. It was getting dark. I heard someone talking to someone else. Shush, he's waking up. Someone was talking about me. I got out of the car. I acted like I did not hear them. I went all around all the five places where you could shoot at this gun range. Nobody was there, George. If they could hypnotize me, I would love it. See if I had contact with them after they closed that cloud cover down. And if I heard something else subconsciously, somebody was there, and the other person told this other one, shush, he's waking up.
Well, let's ask Yvonne, and I'm going to put you on hold. Tommy, get his number. Yvonne, have you had any cases of people who think they have had voices sent into their heads, into their minds, or some kind of messages or anything like that?
Oh, definitely, George. That's very common. Of course, the aliens communicate telepathically. The abductees, experiencers do hear messages many times very clearly. They really do not have to always be taken from their natural environment. They could be in their own home, in their bedrooms, sitting up wide awake, and hearing a message.
Ken from Pasadena is echoing what we talked about when you were first on, Yvonne, but wants to know, what are they hiding? Why don't they make themselves available to us, especially if they're so-called friendly?
That's the million-dollar question. We're asked that all the time. You know, the favorite line question is, why don't they land on the White House lawn? First of all, they're probably afraid we're going to shoot at them first thing, you know.
Well, and we would, and we have.
That's right. I feel that because they are operating on their own agenda, they have a job to do, and they do it well. And that's why we're not getting many answers. I wish they would communicate with me to at least tell me what they're doing so I could help these people, a little bit more, so that I can have an understanding of what their plan is. But, of course, that's not going to happen.
No, not at all. And let me ask you, Robert, in your case, your soldiers, they were armed, right?
Yes, yes.
Did they contemplate shooting at the object?
I'm sure they did.
Mm. But nobody did, right?
As far as I know, nobody did. However, recently heard of a case where the guards, and this happened in 1975, I think, the guards actually shot at the UFO. This was a very similar case to mine.
Not smart to do that.
And they shot something like 185 rounds,
oh,
believe it or not, and to no avail. You know, it didn't do anything.
Yet some cases I hear, they're very vulnerable to conventional weaponry because they're so sophisticated. It's like an old cannonball. They don't know what to do.
Well, yeah.
I've heard that a lot. All right. Well, we're going to come back with some final phone calls for both of you on Coast to Coast AM. Robert's work is called Faded Giant. It's about this incident in Montana. Yvonne Smith, Chosen, Recollections of UFO Abductions Through Hypnotherapy. If you need to email me, that's George at coasttocoastam.com. On our program tomorrow, by the way, we're going to talk a little bit about some monsters. Yes. And then later on, open lines right here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back with final phone calls. Don't touch your dial. And if you're interested in helping out or you want more information on the Washington Press Club, just go to UFOHastings.com. It's linked up at coasttocoastam.com right now. We're going to take the rest of your calls for what is left in this hour. And we've got Yvonne Smith as well. Yvonne, when does your next work get completed? Because that's going to be a fascinating series of stories.
Let's see. I'm working on two books at one time, George. So
don't mix them up.
No. But I'm hoping to get at least one of them. And I'm hoping that mass abduction one I could finish and have it published by June of 2011.
Super.
Mm-hmm. This should be very interesting. That's a lot of work, a lot of transcripts to put together. I'm still doing some regression on that case. So stay tuned. I'm hoping to keep your fingers crossed. I want to have it done by June to take it with me to Roswell in July, of course.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. Houston, Texas, east of the Rockies. Chuck has been waiting. Hello, Chuck.
How are you doing?
Okay.
George, I've got some information that you all might be interested in.
All right.
I'll give it to you, and then I'll hang up.
Okay.
But when I was in second grade, this is, I guess, the fall of 64 and the spring of 65, I lived on an island, Okinawa, and my dad was stationed at Naha Air Force Base. And one day we're out at PE, or recess, whatever you want to call it, and they called us all in on a UFO drill. Now, a fire drill, you go outside to a designated area and they count heads. They had bomb drills in those days. You came in and lined up on the walls. But a UFO drill, you actually got under your desk in your classroom.
And by the way, I hope you're not on a railroad track out there, are you?
They're close. They're all over the place in Houston. Excuse me.
Okay.
But anyway, I'm a little out of breath right now because I saw you were picking me up. But
okay.
Anyway, y'all can talk about that. You ought to be able to verify this. That they had UFO drills in the elementary schools.
Huh. That's fascinating. Did you ever hear of that? Thanks.
I have not heard UFO drills. I certainly remember the drills.
We had bombing drills.
Bombing drills and going, you know, duck and cover.
We had tornado drills. We had all those things.
But I have not heard of UFO drills. That's interesting.
Yeah. I wonder if we could find an old school administrator who would say, yeah, we did it all the time. You never know.
That would be very interesting to research.
Yep, you never know. How long does it take under hypnotherapy? How many sessions do you need to really get the information out of somebody?
Well, it's very hard to say because each case is so unique as far as because of the person. Everybody's different. Definitely you need more than one session. One or two sessions, because it is a lifelong experience, and it's a tremendous puzzle to put together. So I always caution people not to expect too much in maybe one or two sessions.
And do you tape it and let them hear themselves?
Yes, absolutely. I audio tape all the sessions, and they're all welcome to have a copy of it. And every once in a while, I will have it videotaped, you know, with the person's permission, of course, but always audio tape.
Do they ever say, I said that?
Absolutely. Yeah, there is some amnesia during the course of the session, so they're not going to remember everything. But I do give them the suggestion that they will begin to remember more consciously because they spent all those years with these hidden memories and bits and pieces, fragments of the experience. So it's not going to do them any good. It does not serve them if I give them suggestion that they're not going to remember until the next session.
I give them that suggestion. They're going to remember and keep on remembering. I ask them to keep a journal. I ask them to draw what they remember consciously, and in the course of regression, that's all part of the therapy. And it all works together, and it's been very, very effective.
Okay, Ocean City, New Jersey, it's Richie's turn on Coast to Coast. Good morning, Richie.
Good morning, George. I've been trying to get a hold of you for a long time, so I can't believe that I was able to get through.
Yeah, I'm glad you held on there, too.
Yeah, I was involved. You know, it's interesting. I was involved in a UFO incident that included, the Pentagon and the CIA. Two Air Force brass from the Pentagon and three from the CIA. And last year you had I was listening to your show, I don't know when it was, but somebody brought up this incident in Denville, New Jersey. I was singing in this nightclub, and this UFO was so huge, it came over both sides of Route 46 and covered the nightclub I was singing in. And I'm up on stage, and people come running and screaming. I thought it was some kind of joke. I mean, horrified. So I jumped off the stage, and people ran outside, and the thing took off. The next night, I was up there singing, and then two Air Force brass from the Pentagon and the CIA came in yelling, "Can we have your attention? Stop playing." So I stopped playing, and I said, "What kind of nonsense is this?" You know, and they grabbed everybody that saw it and told them to keep their mouth shut and never talk about it. And that was, I don't know, it was like in the 1970s, could be from 1970 to 1973, I think. But the weirdest thing is... a week later, three of these people from the UFO came to my house.
Boy, the government would do anything, Richie, to keep you from singing, wouldn't they?
Yeah. No, I mean, three of the occupants of the UFO came to my house.
What?
And I used to brag that I was never afraid of anything, and I was so horrified. All I remember is falling back in my bed. There were three of them, two men and a woman. And it wasn't that they were, they weren't that much different looking than us, to be honest with you, the ones that came to my house.
Were they, but could you tell that they were different?
Oh, yeah, definitely. But, I mean, back then, everybody would notice if they were walking among us. But today, with the people with their shaved heads and the way so many people look differently, you would look at them because they were really pale. Pale looking, but they really didn't look that much different from us. They actually had baby features, you know, and from what I remember. But all I remember was falling back into my bed, and we had other incidents up there, Picatinny Arsenal, Wanakee Reservoir. I mean, there was a lot of raster sightings, and it was weird. I was doing some kind of experiments that I haven't done in years, and I don't know if that had anything to do with them coming, but you had somebody on your show last year talk about this incident, and then I ran into another person that was there that saw it, and I said, "Did I imagine that?" And he said, "No, I was there too, and I saw it." I said, "No, it was real." But to try to get information about it, there's nothing. I try to look it up on a computer, try to call you, and excuse me, I don't know what. I was so disgusted with myself because I was so horrified that I wish I could have found out what...
There might have been Stanton Friedman, Richie, who was the one who was talking about that. Yvonne, he brought up something interesting here about the way they looked. Almost like us, not quite. Do the people that go under hypnotherapy describe what these entities look like?
They do eventually. It's difficult for someone to describe them in the beginning of their regression sessions because they begin to relive these experiences, and they're so terrified at first that so many times they don't want to even look at the aliens, the entities. And I use techniques to allow them to relive without the fear. And the terror that they felt during the actual experience, then they will begin to describe I ask them to describe the features and so forth, what their touch feels like. But it's interesting because we do come across these human-looking aliens, and you know what we termed coined the term Nordics because they were tall and perfect looking and.
But they look like, you know, humans.
They look humans. Now, was it Richie? I was going to ask him what made them a little bit different. He said they didn't look quite like us.
Well, he said they had baby-like appearance. Their skin was lighter, almost pasty-looking.
Pasty.
And they were bald.
And that's interesting, because the ones that look human will actually be able to pass as, you know, just someone walking.
They've got hair, everything.
Mm-hmm. Especially now we feel that.
Are their eyes bigger?
The ones that we call Nordics, not exactly. They don't have the wraparound eyes, but it's something about their eyes that are different. I have in my book Chosen, the very last chapter is about a woman, and this was back in the 60s, I believe it was right after the Hills incident, where she came across someone who we could call Nordic, and she said it was something about his eyes that it scared her, but not because she felt threatened, but because she felt he was looking right through her.
Mm-hmm.
Could read her thoughts.
Let's go to Olympia, Washington. Greg's turn on Coast to Coast. Hey, Greg.
Hey, George. How you doing?
Okay. Glad you got in.
I have a question for Yvonne Smith.
She's ready to go.
All right. Where does she think these aliens come from, based on her study of the extraction of the 15 implants that she was talking about?
Can you come up with any kind of a guess with that, Yvonne?
I couldn't. It was just a conversation and conference I had with Dr. Roger Lear, and he would have to. We have more to discuss about that, but I'm going to let Roger go ahead at some point and
defer to him.
And go through the research on it, because that's going to be very interesting, George.
All right, let's go to Niagara Falls on the Canadian side. Marie's with us on the international line. Go ahead,
Hi.
Marie. Hi.
I just wanted to ask more about the guidance systems. Like in 1967, how would they be set? Would they be programmed? Are they magnetic?
Oh, they were all programmed. And what was, and they were shielded. They had hard wires, too.
But by hand or by a computer?
Everything was computerized then. It was 1967. They weren't great computers, but we had computers.
Okay. That's all I wanted to know,
okay.
If it was computerized.
All right, you got it. Next up, truck driving in Nevada, Paul's turn, west of the Rockies. Hey, Paul, go ahead.
Hi, George. Hi, Robert and Yvonne.
Hi.
Hello.
Robert, I was in Warren Air Force Base between 73 and 76, and I was involved with two of those instances where the UFOs came down. One was on Foxtrot, and it was just, I was a SAT team leader at the time, and we were at the launch site, and it would not reset, it would not work, and we were told to stay there. The two lights that were above us moved around a few times for about an hour, then they left, and the launch site reset.
What did you think was going on, Paul?
Oh, we knew something was going on, but we didn't know what. And about a month and a half later, we were at hotel at the site, and I had topsite duties, and my SAP team was out working the field, and we had a launch crew changeover at that time. It was about 6 or 7 o'clock at night in the winter, and we had three UFOs over the top of the site,
man,
of our launch site. And like he said, everything went down, and we had the launch crew there doing the exchange, you know, changing from one crew to the next, and we were there, and we just looked at them, and you know, we thought, well, should we shoot at them? And it's like, well, if they can come that far, those M16 bullets probably won't do much.
Did you have to sign a security oath as well, Paul?
Well, we didn't fight anything, but they sure gave us a hard time. And always I came and said, you know, you didn't see it, you didn't see it, you didn't see it. Don't talk about it. But we didn't sign anything because they didn't exist.
Man.
Interesting.
And it's just amazing. You hear about it from Montana, from Minot, North Dakota, and from, you know, as we used to call it, Frankie Warren's Rocket Ranch. It was the only Air Force base in the world that had no runway.
All over the place. I mean, did anybody think for a moment that these might have been the Russians, the Soviets?
No, I don't think so. I think even with the SR-71 in construction or out at that time, nothing could make right angle turns like those craft could.
No, that's a good point. That's a great story. Paul, thank you. A couple more calls. Let's go to Jane in Galveston, Texas. Hi, Jane. Go ahead.
Hey, fascinating program.
It is.
I was wondering, what do you think about this, and maybe you have experience in this and the regression aspects with any of the people. You know, the pineal gland, once it's shut off, there's the loss of a conscious mind on the person that has had it shut off. You know, now I don't know with mind control experiments and things like this. And it's been alleged that in some cases people have committed crimes that they were not aware.
Well, last Sunday, Dr. Joy Pugh talked about the pineal gland and that it was being used as an antenna and signals were being sent to it to have people do things.
So what my question is, are you ready for the deluge, which I think there are going to be quite a few people that'll be contacting you to testify on their behalf in courts of law that they could pass a lie detector that they did not do that crime, even though all the evidence shows that they did. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
Boy, that's interesting.
It'll be a paradox, to be sure. I'm not sure it would hold up in court, though. That's why we need Robert Shapiro back here to ask him that.
I would sure like to listen in on that one. Really can't offer anything myself on that. I know that the aliens, some of their implants, very often are deep within the nasal cavity near the brain, right around, I guess, where the pineal gland is located.
What's your gut tell you, though, Yvonne, that this is good stuff or bad stuff with these abductions?
You know, I don't want to put it in a black and white box, but the thing is with everything that's happening to people, and it's so secretive, I'm just not sure where this is all going to lead. When everyone is programmed, so to speak, to one day all of a sudden click in and they'll know what they're supposed to be doing and for what reason.
Well, you would think that if a species got to the point of that kind of technology, mm-hmm. that they would be benevolent and loving and perfect. I don't think they are.
Well, it's hard to say that they're totally benevolent. I feel with all my research, talking to so many people who've had these experiences, they're not in it for our own good.
That's a good point. Thank you so much, Yvonne. Great show with you and Robert Salas. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. It'll be a Friday. Until then, be safe, everyone.